Lonnie Ackerman, and with Sean Carroll, who I guess was here last week. And if you find the subject interesting, you can look at it here. This is kind of an informal talk. I just have notes and I'll try to sketch out. I'll just try to sketch out the idea and why we think it was an interesting subject to explore. I have to say from the beginning that the phenomena we're going to explore, it's possible that it just cannot occur for dynamical reasons. This is sort of the minus of the more phenomenological approach to speculative ideas, as opposed to the string theorists who usually have a well-defined formalism, and when they derive something, you know it can, at least in principle, occur. I'm not going to have a real model. When I explore the in quotes model that I use, it's more really a scenario than an actual model that I am sure dynamically could exist. And you'll see what I mean in a little more detail as I go on. Okay, so what we're going to explore are the consequences of breaking rotational invariance. Of course, we're familiar in condensed matter systems with the possibility of breaking rotational invariance. You could have, for example, a magnet where all the spins line up, even though you have rotational invariance in the spin-spin interactions, you could have a breaking of rotational invariance. And that's the same type of idea that we want to explore. So what we're going to imagine, what we're going to explore is the possibility that during the inflationary era, rotational invariance was broken by a small amount. And somehow, as we exited the inflationary era, the dynamics changed. Well, it has to change somewhat because you have to exit the era. The dynamics changed and rotational invariance was restored. So all the laws of physics following inflation will be manifestly rotationally invariant. There'll be no spontaneous breaking of the rotational invariance. The breaking only occurred at very early times when the, during this inflationary era. So if that's what happens, if this spontaneous breaking of rotational invariance only occurs during inflation, what could be its signatures today? What could it influence? Well, one of the key roles that inflation plays, apart from having a large expansion to solve the usual problems, is that it provides a mechanism for generating density perturbations. And those primordial density perturbations are what give rise to the perturbations, for example, in the microwave background there. Yes?
Sir, but doesn't it also isotropize the universe?
Yes.
So
standard inflation does. But if you have this breaking of rotational invariance, I'm going to show you a model where you get different expansion rates along with different directions.
Yeah, I know, but isn't that kind of basically trying not quite to solve the problem? Isn't there a fine tuning?
No, there's no fine tuning. What you need is that the breaking of rotational invariance is small. And I'll characterize it more explicitly, what has to be small. So then you still get enough expansion to smooth things out.
This was before fluctuation. You would say that inflation was a way of solving a modulating isotropy.
Right.
So it looks like a contradiction in terms.
Well, let's just go on. You'll see how it works. You might not like it, but at least you'll see what the idea is. Okay, so let me write down an equation. So the primordial density perturbations, they're usually, you write a delta. You work in Fourier space. You say delta of k. So this is the primordial density perturbations. It's characterized by some power spectrum times a delta function. And k here denotes the magnitude of the wave vector k. So the fact that this is a delta function of k minus q, the fact that different modes don't couple to each other, that's a consequence of translational invariance, which we're not going to talk about violating. The fact that the power spectrum p of k only depends on the magnitude of the wave vector k, that's a consequence of rotational invariance. And so if we don't have rotational invariance during inflation, then that's the aspect that that we might imagine is changed. So if during inflation there's some preferred direction, let's call it n, how could that preferred unit vector, let's say, how could that preferred direction enter in to our prediction for this power spectrum? Well, the usual way you analyze such problems is you treat the preferred direction n as a spurion. You say, even though it's a fixed vector, you let it transform under rotations like this, and then you write down things that are rotationally invariant. And that's the usual spurion analysis for characterizing some breaking of a symmetry of this type. So our p of k, it's going to change if we don't have rotational invariance. It's going to become a p of the magnitude of k. And I'm going to write that, kind of a confusing notation, I better call, put a prime on it, as something rotationally invariant. And I'm going to always imagine the breaking of rotational invariance is small, otherwise we would get into problems. And so I'm going to expand in a power series in n. The first term you could write down is n dot k times some number, times something, or some function of the max. Let me make this the, oopsie. Hazardous job. There could be some function of k here, but I'm going to assume that we have some sort of parity symmetry, k goes to minus k. So this thing doesn't occur. It ends up in every type of model I tried to construct that was the case. And so the first term that you would get is some function g of k n dot k hat squared. There's higher order terms, but they're going to be much smaller. And so you can see that the fact that rotational invariance is broken by a small amount, so we can expand in it, leads us to a characterization of the breaking that's characterized by two quantities, a direction on the sky, it's a unit vector n, and a function of k. Now, p of k, this is the standard result you would get for inflation. P of k has a particular form for inflation. At the very primordial level, you might say p of k goes like 1 over k cubed, the characteristic of Fourier transforming a two-point function into sitter space, and then it gets promoted to going linearly in k by certain transfer function effects. And the form of this spectrum really arises, it really has a special form. You might say, well, why is it a simple power? Well, it's very unlikely it would have any shape, at least over the wavelengths that are of interest for astrophysics, because all the numbers that go into inflation are particle physics type numbers, all of the dimensional numbers, and of course cosmology has to do with very large distance scales, and so you wouldn't imagine that you could generate any shape. This type of manifoldness argument suggests that it would go like a simple power. And the 1 over k cubed is the power that corresponds to when you average the fluctuations over a horizon volume, they have a constant value averaged over the horizon. Yeah?
If it's a density profile, then I think it should go like k.
Yeah, that happens from the transfer function part. This is really all the way into the inflationary era where the two-point correlation of the standard field has a 1 over k cubed. And then it gets right, and then it gets changed to going linear in k, which is the Harrison-Dildonovich form. Yeah? Your question?
Oh, I do. So the argument about parity, is it an observation argument or is it?
No. It's It's an argument that when I tried to construct a model, I always ended up with this term being absent and this term being there. And it might be that the models, it might be deeper than parity. It might be that you have to add something time reversal invariant, so not invariant at the level of a Lagrangian, because k.
So this is going back to the Skinner field.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm not sure that this is completely general, but I'm going to assume that we have this parity time k goes to minus k symmetry, because I always seem to find that when I try to construct a model. If I could construct a model that gave me a term like this, you'll see from the analysis I do to this term that you could similarly do this term. But we're going to study this one because that seems to be what I always found. Yeah.
The fact that there's a difference between northern and southern hemispheres being caused that this curves are blocked.
Pardon?
The fact that there is a difference, if there is a difference between northern and southern hemisphere, then it causes that the linear terms survive.
Well,
no, no. Actually, the thing I mentioned about the derivation is that it looks like the thing. There is a difference. It looks like it's actually parity equal.
Well, are you talking? So the effects that are. I'm not going to try to try to explain the anomalies that are observed on large scales. In fact, the effect that we're going to get is not confined to the low moments. So, from my point of view, it's kind of a minus that we have these anomalies on the very largest scales. But this is not an attempt to explain that. Any other questions before I go on? Okay, so I'm going to break the talk up into two parts. One part is, now that we have this, how would I calculate the influence of this on the microwave background anisotropy? That's part one. And the second part will be to construct a sort of a model that illustrates how you would generate this during inflation. But I wanted to say a little more. So P of k goes like 1 over k cubed. It gives you the scale invariant spectrum. And really, at the level of calculations, it comes about because the Hubble constant is constant during inflation. And the violation of rotational invariance that we're going to introduce is going to be a small perturbation. The space is still going to be approximately de Sitter over the whole time of inflation. And because of that, you'd expect that g of k wouldn't have any shape in k, that this part would also be scale invariant. And so that this would go over to a constant independent of k. And indeed, we'll find that that's approximately true in the model. It's really not a complete model. I don't know what to call it. Maybe I should call it a scenario. But I'll just keep calling it a model. In the model we construct. And so what we found very interesting about this idea is that then the breaking of rotational invariance is characterized in a very simple way, just by three parameters, one constant and two directions on the sky. And you'll see in a moment that affects all the correlations of the multipole moments. And so you could just try to constrain this one constant as a function of the direction, the assumed preferred direction of the sky from microwave data. OK, so first part one, which is how to calculate the influence on the multiple moments of the microwave background anisotropy. That's a lesson in YLM, sort of undergraduate level mathematical physics. But then we'll go on later and do the inflationary model.
So the reason why this propagates to all the modes is exactly the T-scale invariant.
Yeah. If I wanted to explain the anomalies observed, and there are papers that try to do that, I would have to give this something to cut off. But I'm not going to do that. I want to try to say, what do I expect generically if this was really true? Not try to build a model that explains what's seen. It's hard to know the statistical significance of what's seen, whether it's a background effect. So that's absolutely right. Certain models, people build the models to try to explain the observed effects. And some of the results that we derived and were also derived by them in that context. In particular, one paper had quite a bit of overlap But luckily, I don't ever have to mention the name of the authors of that paper, and I don't have to view it as any kind of competition. And that's because their name is totally unpronounceable. Let's see if I can find it in the references. It's kind of cool.
First name isn't pronounced.
Maybe the first name is pronounceable again. Yeah. Should have written it down before. Yeah, see, you work in this field. You got to end up with a paper with 60 references. Why does that happen? It's because you get like 700 emails. So out of the 700, you pick 60. People are really touchy in this. Can't find it. Anyways, it's got a lot of consonants, 32 letters. It's got stuff like C and an accent underneath. You know?
Is it the paper we didn't pronounce, and then it's
Contaldi
and
Cardoso? No, I don't think so. I got that one referenced. That was it.
Completely can't find it.
It's such a funky name, you think it would stand out in your reference. I don't want to waste too much time on this, although it is kind of funny. Okay. Informal seminar. I don't have to mention all the competition. Although I am recorded. You probably get sued nowadays. Okay, let's go on to the microwave background anisotropy. So we're just going to assume this, and I want to give you a feeling for how it would influence the microwave background anisotropy. I've got to apologize a little bit. I'm a particle theorist. What do I really know about the microwave background anisotropy? Luckily, all the parts that involve astrophysics are hidden in one function, which I'll call theta. And I'll never tell you what the kind of compute thing is. I'll get away with that. Okay, so what we're measuring is delta t over t and some function of the direction in the sky, e. So e is a unit vector. And the thing we're going to talk about are the multiple moments. Okay, I just got to know how many boards there really are. Oh my god. This is awesome. Okay, never going to get it back down again. Yeah. Well, I guess I'll work here for now because I started. So ALM is some integral against the spherical harmonics. And now I'm going to put in what the astrojocks teach us. That delta T over T of E, you can write as an integral dk. A sum over L, 2L plus 1 over 4 pi, some Legendre polynomials that depend on the relative direction between E and K, the primordial density perturbations, and then a function which knows about a lot of astrophysics, a transfer type function thing, theta L. But it only depends on the magnitude of K. And that's because the laws of physics are rotationally invariant after inflation. And so if you want to know how to calculate theta L of K, you can go and read through Donaldson. He'll teach you how to calculate theta L of K. We're just going to keep it as some function that's known. It has to do with the dynamics well after inflation. All that cares about inflation, about the primordial physics, is characterized in delta of K. So the thing that you're going to calculate, first of all, in standard inflation, it's usually assumed, and it's a very good approximation, that delta of K is a Gaussian variable, a normal variable. And then everything about it is characterized by its two-point correlation. All the higher-order correlations are determined by a two-point correlation for a normal random variable. Any linear combination of, so delta at each K is normal. Any linear combination of normal variables is still normal. And so the ALMs, if I tell you they're two-point correlations, I know everything about them statistically. And so that's what people usually talk about. The two-point correlation, ALM, AL prime, M prime, star, complex conjugate. And we're going to break it up into two parts. Oops. This is part that doesn't depend on G, the part that comes from the one there, that's the part that is compared with experiment, the result of standard inflation. And then there's something new that's proportional to G star, or to G of K, if we don't assume that it's a constant. We already know a few things. Because of rotational invariance, this is a Kronecker delta that sets L equal to L prime and M equal to M prime. And then it has a particular shape in K that you get from the transfer function theta L of K in the primordial spectrum. But this object here breaks the rotational invariance. And so we're certainly going to get terms that exist even when L is not equal to L prime and M is not equal to M prime. And even if we look at L equal to M L prime, we'll get terms even if we look when L is equal to L prime and M is equal to M prime, we'll get functional dependence on the value of M that's different. Okay, so let me just sketch how you do the calculation. It's not surprising, given that this is the second power, that the L's that you can connect differ by at most two. This is all what we should expect, so let me just show you the math. Okay, bored heaven here. Okay, so what do you use to do the calculation? Well, you just use this identity from you learned it the first time you did E and L. The fact that PL of K dot E, you can write as 4 pi over 2L plus 1, the sum M equals minus L to L, so YLM along the direction E, and YLM along the direction K. So you just put that in. So ALM is given up above. You have the PL of K here. You put that in, and then you use the orthogonality of the YLM to do the integration over the direction E. And then we get left with the following formula. And so now if I want to take ALM, A star, L prime, M prime, I just have two of these. There's an integral dk, d3k, put a vector sign on it, an integral dq. YLM of K, direction K, YLM L prime M prime star, direction Q, sorry. There's the theta L of K, theta L prime of Q. It's a real function. And then I get the two-point correlation. So this we're going to replace, remember, by 2 pi cubed, a delta function of k minus q. Oh, shoot. P of k, 1 plus okay, so let's see what happens here. So first of all, let's do the one part, just a review of the standard inflation part. So to do the one part, of course, what happens? Well, it collapses it to a single integral. here, and then the, to do the, and then when you do the integration over the direction of the single variable k, you use the orthogonality of the YLMs, and so you get that the not part that I mentioned before is going to have the delta LL prime, delta MM prime, and then some 0 to infinity k squared dk, theta L squared p of k. So the results depend on L. They don't depend on M. And that's all just a consequence of rotational invariance. And of course, I mean, you need the particular function theta L of k to really do this, but we're not going to go that far. So now we just want to do the same thing to get delta L L prime. And so we're still going to have the same delta function that sets k to q. So it'll collapse to one integral here. And we'll have, but this part here has dependence on the direction of k. And so all you do is the following. You introduce sort of spherical decomposition of the unit vector n. And then you write n dot k hat squared. You can work it out. It's just 4 pi over 3 n plus y 1 1 So now you're plugging this into your integral, and you've got 4 YLMs. And then you just use additional angular momentum to add them up and do the integral. I mean, you can combine these 3 YLMs to 1, and then you use the orthogonality, just a bunch of Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. I'm not going to do that for you. You get a whole bunch of messy formulas, but it really is just Clebsch-Gordan coefficients at that point. So that's the general method for calculating the influence on the microwave background. You get very explicit formulas for how things depend on L and M. They're very different. The correction term, I could write them down for you, but they're just sort of huge things. But they're still just characterized by 3 numbers. The direction of which N is, 2 angles if you'd like on the sky, and G star. So that's one of the reasons why we thought this was interesting, that you get this very characteristic signature that you can compare with observations, at least if you understand the data a lot better than we do.
So the problem is going to be obviously the cosmic variance.
But it exists down to low to high multiples, so you should be able to put some sort of constraint on it. I'm not sure it would be very powerful. There were some analysis that, because of the observations, that tried to put constraints. Things like the bispectrum were introduced. And when I looked at that paper, which actually did try to put some constraints, it appeared that the constraints were very weak. They would only limit G star to be less than a number like 1, not very small at all.
But the problem I can see is you don't know the end prior.
You don't know the what?
The end direction.
You don't know the preferred direction, that hurts.
So you have to basically try them all. One of them is going to maximize the effect of the gradient.
Well, let me give you an example of one effect, and then you'll get a better sense for that. Okay, so the formulas in general suck in that they're incredibly complicated. But if I look at this quantity delta Lm when L prime is equal to L and M prime is equal to M, it's a pretty simple formula. So let me just write that one down. And then you can get a sense of how it depends on its direction on the sky. So I think you'll see it's not quite so bad as you might have thought. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to divide out the the zeroth order result, because I've looked at L prime equal to M and M prime equal to M, all the dependence, when I normalize it in this way, on P of K cancels out. And so I just get some simple function that depends on this direction. So it's the G star over 2 sine squared theta star plus 3, oh, sine theta star is the angle between how the experimentalists characterize the microwave background, their z-axis on the sky when they write their multiples, and our preferred direction m. When you define multiples, you pick some z-axis by convention. So, as an example, let's look at this term.
That's cos squared theta star, isn't it?
Yeah. There was an invisible S there?
Yeah, I guess so. I missed it.
Yeah, it's not nice. But yeah, that happens. Thank you. So you can see, let's take a look at this term just to get a feeling for the question. So it's true that this depends on the direction, but unless you get unlucky, so it's almost zero, there'll be something here, and then you would get a form that depends on M like this, and you would try to look for that. So it complicates the fact of this direction, but it's not hopeless.
Right. But I think in practice, what you would do, given we have a covariance matrix, you just find the likelihood directly with the latent.
Yeah, you fit to everything at once.
And then you basically would find one direction that could optimize the model.
Yeah. I'm just illustrating this to say that, you know, it's true it depends on this, but you know, it doesn't come in an incredibly complicated way the way the m's do. It's just quadratic in this direction. It's the m pluses and n minuses. And
so I'm puzzled because theta star seems to be convention.
Well, so are the ALMs.
I understand, but if I choose a particular direction for my z-axis,
right,
by convention, and I choose it, so 3 cos squared theta star minus 1 is equal to 0, then I've lost all my dependence.
Then you've lost this dependence, but you won't lose all the dependence. The things when m prime is not equal to m, they'll still have dependence there. Yeah, you
just
could.
Just that one.
Yeah, just that one. Sorry, I should have made that clear.
I mean,
it also, when you look at the other ones, it also depends on the azimuthal angle, phi.
I mean, you don't really need to make g equals g star. Right? It's not too hard to extend this to general. I mean, in general, g should have some k dependence.
Yeah, so if g had k dependence, then what happens is, so outside of the angle, outside this part here, the delta L prime,
I mean, you won't get this nice cancellation.
Yeah, that's right. So delta, this delta L M, it's got a part which we could just call CLM, C prime L prime, that involves these integrals against the YLMs, and then it's got another part times. And if I keep the G of K, it would go here. But it makes it a lot harder for observers to do some fit now, because each of these things, for each L and L prime, could have arbitrary values because G is some unknown function. So if you want to do some fit to get a strong constraint, you're much better off just saying there's the three numbers. And you'll see in the model we construct, which I'm going to work on next, the extent to which this is independent of K. It's not exact. Okay, that's all I want to say about comparing with observation. There's probably a lot more you could say, but this is all that I'm confident to say, so I'm more or less restricted to Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. That's the idea. So a very characteristic signature
just three parameters for all the multifolds. And lots of other ones you can look at. You no longer going to be restricted to L equal to L prime and M equal to M prime because of this effect.
So if the linear term survived in N dot K, then?
Well, then it would be a different set of Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. You'd be combining three. You'd be combining. It's not so hard to see how it goes, right? You'd express this just like I did before. You'd be combining three YLMs. You'd get different formulas, different Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. You'd connect L's and L primes that differ by one unit, not by two units. And you could work out those formulas very easily using the methods I've described. And the reason I didn't pursue that further is because I could never construct a model that realized that. I think it has to do with the fact that that standard symmetries that usually exist when you talk about inflation models like time reversal and probably parity prevent such a term. It might be fun to try to construct a more complicated model that gave it. I don't think it's impossible. Or at least I don't know if it's impossible. I haven't tried that hard. Any other comments or questions?
Did you actually look at the data and see what these tests?
There was only, so we didn't look at the data ourselves. Clearly, Sean Carroll and I are not going to look at the data. But there were papers that tried to compare, that tried to characterize violations of rotational invariance in the primordial spectrum and compare with the data. These papers were, they introduced the notion of the Bi spectrum. And if you look at the constraints in those papers, change them to a constraint on G, they were very weak.
Because my sense is that you actually do the fit with this model.
Well, somebody who's more familiar with the data has to do it. Not
the problem is that, of course, you always improve the fit if you have more parameters. So there's always this issue, the trade-off between the two things.
Well, yeah. So the thing you could ask is not whether you improve the fit, but what's the statistical significance of the determined value of G star?
Do you have an upper bound on G star?
If it's not statistically significant, the value of G star you would extract from the fit, then you would quote it as an upper bound.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask, do you know what that is? Has anybody worked out that?
If I compare with the things that exist in the literature now, it's a very weak bound on G star. Less than one. But I don't think that was an optimal fit to the data. They didn't make all the assumptions we're making. And nobody has done that. Our paper's only a couple of months old. I don't know if a theorist can make it. I think someone that really understands the data has to do it because systematic effects are really important for something like this. So, but it's certainly not going to be me anyway. Some people have contacted us. I'm sure a fit will eventually be done. It's something you should do. I mean, even if you think this is incredibly unlikely that rotational variance is violated, you should constrain it by the data.
It's a theoretical parameter that can be done.
Yeah.
No, but it's funny because actually people try to get a hang of the noise and systematics by these off-diagonal terms.
Yeah, you see, that's why I think it'll be very hard to get a limit because the fact that rotational invariance constrains the form of this is used as a powerful way to remove systematic errors. So I don't know how strong the constraint is.
But like when you try to when you see the data and you try to get rid of the velocity of our velocity with respect to the
dipole moment.
Sorry.
The dipole moment.
Yeah, the dipole moment. Probably, yeah, you're doing exactly this.
Well, what you're saying is that actually something which is worrying, there could be leakage with a higher multiple if you don't do it properly. But that's a different matter. See, that's just L equals one, right?
Yeah, that'll have a different.
This is a modulation, which is like an L equals two times everything.
That's right.
The dipole is an L equals one plus the rest.
That might make extracting something linear in n dot k more problematic. Okay, should we go on and I'll briefly discuss how we tried to look at a little model just to see whether we were doing junk? Okay, so let me discuss the inflation model.
You might still be doing a job, but... So I don't want to take any of the dynamics I'm going to propose seriously. It's just classical physics I'm going to do. I don't really know whether this phenomena can occur theoretically. Maybe there are constraints that really prevent it, some deep constraints. But we're just going to go on and pursue a little classical model and see whether it gives us something that falls into the category of what I propose. Okay, so we got to introduce some four vector that gets an expectation or that has an expectation value along a particular direction. And so I'll introduce it like this, mu. Awesome notation. And we'll say it satisfies a constraint. And we're going to imagine that this m squared is small. And then I'm just going to make an action. I had to use the opposite metric because I was collaborating with a relativist. Sorry, particle physicists who live on the West Coast some of the time. Okay, there's the R. Then I have the energy density. I'm going to treat the inflaton, just giving me a cosmological constant during inflation. I'm going to make a very simplified toy thing. Basically, the fluctuations during inflation, the fluctuations that give rise to density perturbations, come about from fluctuations in a massless scalar field. So instead of doing inflaton dynamics correctly, I'm just going to add a massless scalar field and calculate its two-point function and see the influence of the breaking of rotational baryonic's two-point function. So then there's a Lagrangian for U. The fact that this picks out a preferred direction, Lagrange density, will influence the dynamics. And then there's our massless scalar field we're going to add, and its two-point chi, its two-point correlation is what we're going to compute. So there's a Lagrangian for chi. Got the minus because of the wrong side metric. And then there's a Lagrangian for, oh man, it's never ended. You don't mind if I stay after the lecture and play with the board for a little while, dude. Yeah, so we're going to add the Lagrangian for U, and there'll just be a bunch of kinetic terms. And then I have to implement the constraint, so I'll implement it with the Lagrange multiplier, lambda. And then we'll just plug this in, and we'll solve Einstein's equations. So, of course, we make an ansatz, and then find the solution.
Are you worried about stability?
No. I'll say one little thing about it. Yeah, so you might think that, so talking about stability. So first of all, if beta 1 is positive, this is a normal sine kinetic term. It's not a ghost kinetic term. Of course, it's a four vector, so you might worry about the knot component having a ghost. So all I'm going to say about stability is it's possible to choose beta 2 and beta 3, so this kinetic term corresponds to a standard field strength square, if you imagine that U sigma is the four vector part of it. So it's possible to have a standard F mu nu squared kinetic term for a particular choice of beta 1 and the others, and beta 1 is positive for that. But that is actually why I kept mentioning at the beginning that the dynamics might prevent something like this from actually happening. There are no real examples like this of real theories where you spontaneously break rotational invariance through the expectation value of a fundamental form vector. People have written a lot of papers on this subject, mostly to do with the four vector having an expectation value in the notch component. But we're just changing that so it's in the spatial component. So let me go on. So I'm certainly not going to do quantum physics in this scalar field. I'm just going to treat it classically. I'm not even going to do a full stability analysis for small fluctuations of the background I'm looking at. I just want to get a sense of how this model, this very toy model, would influence the two-point function of the field chi. I'm just trying to check for the scale invariance, whether that idea persists. I'm not trying to promote this as the right, in quotes, model or scenario. So I'm going to line up U with some direction. So I'll line it up with the z-axis. So that's like choosing the n-hat to be along the z-axis. And then you just stick this in. You solve Einstein's equations. It's a lot of fun. I actually did it last time I was in this area, when I was sitting on a committee reviewing the Perimeter Institute for something for NSERC. I went home to visit my mom after, but my mom's like 84 years old. I got lots of time to compute. I was at my mom. So I'm not going to bore you with any of the details of that, clearly. So we're going to assume that at the beginning of inflation, the A's and B's are equal. Then somehow this four vector turns on during inflation. And the A's and B's, when you solve Einstein's equations, then evolve exponentially. But the Hubble constants are different. So HA, sorry, oh, this board doesn't go up. And they just differ. HA is equal to HB 1 plus 16 pi G beta 1 m squared. Doesn't actually depend on the difference on beta 2 and beta 3. I don't really have any understanding of that. That's what I got, what we got. So it's this difference between HA and HB that's going to induce the anisotropy we're interested in. If I want to have it be a small effect over the whole inflationary era, I'm going to need the number of E foldings times HA minus HB to be a small quantity in order for G star to be a small quantity. So that's the main assumption. If it's not small, then I can't truncate the series in powers of n dot k. Anyways, it should be small. Geez Louise, at least approximately rotationally invariant. You'd think we would have known if there was an order one violation of rotational invariance. So it's still going to be approximately the Sitter space. I want to say one thing that makes me, one of the things that makes me nervous about this model is that when you calculate the stress tensor, and you know, there's sort of these standard energy conditions, there's the dominant energy condition, there's the strong energy condition, yada, yada, yada. This violates a lot of those energy conditions. In other words, I can find for beta 1 positive, for the one that will correspond to a standard FU nu squared type kinetic term, if I calculate T mu nu, the stress tensor, times, I can find a time-like vector T such that this thing is less than zero. So that might be a hint that you really dynamically could never make this in a more realistic model. I don't know how to address that issue. Maybe it's something that my string theory colleagues could address. whether this is actually possible to have a four vector have an expectation value. But that, this does make me a little bit nervous.
It's not the first time negative energy is appearing as well. It's, I mean, it's not a big deal.
You're not nervous? Okay, I'm glad. I'm a little nervous. Okay, so.
It's not surprising in ways related to the question about stability.
Well, I don't think it is. I don't think it will be unstable because I at least the small fluctuations because I can run a standard field strength term. But there's something a little funny about it because of this. It might actually be unstable at some reason. I don't know. But I don't want to take the dynamics too seriously. I just want to have a situation where it is broken. At least as far as the background is concerned, if I can go ahead and calculate the two-point correlation of my field chi and see if the analog of g of k is approximately independent of k. That was the main purpose of this in quotes model. It's not really a model because I haven't put any dynamics in that causes this break. I just forced it by a constraint. But I tried to build actual models. But they all didn't work. They either came out too small or.
So is your constraint that you're close to the sitter is that m is much less than m prime, or little m, or is it m much less than the Hubble constant?
It's really m much less than the vacuum energy that gives rise to the Hubble constant because it's. Yeah, this is not right. This should be over the average Hubble constant. So I guess that's HB plus 2HA over 3. Sorry, yeah, thank you. This should be dimensionless if it's, yeah, so the M bonds cancel out here and here. So, well, we could go, let's go back. So. The difference here, well, I guess it is actually m
over
m Planck. Yeah, sorry. Because these things cancel out against the h bar roughly, and so it's really g times m squared. So the m, yeah, it can be a pretty big m. It just has to be significantly less than m Planck. Right, thank you. Any other questions, comments? Okay, so how do I do this computation? We have a scalar field, chi, and I'm just going to do standard perturbation theory. It's not very hard. So I'm going to introduce a fictitious background space-time, g mu nu bar, which is rotationally invariant. So it's going to expand exponentially at a rate set by this Hubble constant h bar. And then I'll write out this Lagrangian, and I'll write it as g mu nu minus the fictitious, well, there's a root, I guess I'll write out the Lagrangian for chi, I'll write it as a part of rotationally invariant metric, and the difference of the true one, which has the a's and b's and not expanding with respect to a bar, I'll treat as a perturbation. And I'll do standard perturbation theory for quantum field theory. I'll go to the interaction picture, I'll quantize it. Everything's just quadratic. It's free fields. All you do is take a bunch of commutators of the free fields. It's time dependent, but it's still just free field theory. So it's not a big deal. So what is it that you end up computing? You end up saying, well, I want to calculate a two-point function of chi. And so there's some part that would be the same as standard inflation that gives you the Fourier transform goes like 1 over k cubed. So that's this first term. And then there's the perturbation. You get some integral from the beginning of the rotational body, non-invariance to the time you're looking at. Some expectation value, the commutator of the interaction Hamiltonian with the two fields. So this term here, if I Fourier transformed it, goes something like the Hubble constant squared h bar squared over 2k cubed. That's the standard 1 over k cubed that would give rise to our power spectrum phi of k. And this just gives you some other correction. But you can compute it. Well, when I say the Fourier transform goes like that, that's for modes whose wavelengths are well outside the horizon. It goes to a constant. So if I had more time, I'd do the computation, but or sketch it a little bit more. But basically, hi is quadratic in the fields, and they're free fields, chi I. So you just calculate explicitly all the commutators, do the integral over time, go to the limit for modes are well outside the horizon. This part also goes goes to a constant, and I'll just tell you what you get. It should be clear, at least in principle, that anyway, it's just a standard computation. Not that I didn't get it wrong the first four times, but it's standard nonetheless. So usually when you do these computations, you don't use the tau here, you go to conformal time. Everything's much easier in conformal time. And the property that you look at, so this is what we might call the shift in the power spectrum due to our perturbation. So it goes like 9 over 4 epsilon sub h. What was epsilon sub h? Sorry, got a little flustered because I'm running late. So this is the thing that's small. And I've assumed it's small. Otherwise, I'd have to work to higher orders in the
interaction Hamiltonian.
And I made a lot of approximations, even at this order. So we got 9 quarter, we got h bar squared over k cubed, and then we got a log of k over h bar. So this would, without the log, if the log was a number, this would correspond to the scale invariance. And so it's not exactly scale invariant. But it ends up, this is not the end of the story. And the reason it's not the end of the story is kind of a tricky fact that we didn't quite appreciate until towards the end of the computation. And that's that when you're done with inflation, you end up, we started off with the A's and B's equal, then they evolved, and they ended up differing by a little bit. So you end up with coordinates where you've got a different number here and a number here. Well, the fact that you have different numbers there is not a violation of rotational invariance, because you can just rescale your coordinates to absorb that. But still, when the observers tell you the power spectrum is something, they use standard coordinates for your x, y, and z axis. They don't have different things there. And so I got to rescale my coordinates back to the standard coordinates where rotational invariance is manifest. And that changes the answer. You get here minus the number of e-foldings, n. And it ends up that you can combine all this stuff together now. And it tells you that g of k, at least in this very toy situation, is 9 halves epsilon h, the log of the physical wavelength, not the covalent one, the physical one at the end of inflation, divided by the Hubble constant, this Hubble constant h bar. So the q's, if you ask how much do the q's vary over, you see, this is like the log of the scale factor. So you put it downstairs here. The scale factor just changes the k over h to a q. So it just converts it to physical wavelength. So this q, if you look at the scales that are probed by the microwave background anisotropy, it goes over about 3 orders of magnitude. So q is not a fixed number, depending on what multiple moments you're probing. It's going over 3 orders of magnitude. So that's the great thing about a log, that adds. So the log, as far as changes of q's in the log, that's about 7 log of 10 q. The log itself is about 60 in size, just because we needed at least 60 e foldings. And so there's a 10% variation of g with k in this model over the range of things that are probed by the microwave background anisotropy. So that's the extent in the toy model we constructed that things are independent of k. It's not a perfect approximation by any means. Okay, that's all I wanted to say. There's lots of interesting things you could do further. You could try to construct a model that's linear. You could try to analyze stability in the context of this model if you wanted to. The most important thing, though, is not the model. It's really the fact that there's a very simple characterization of this effect. And it would certainly be very interesting to see what the microwave background is telling us about how small it has to be. Thank you. Yeah?
Just a brief comment. I think it is very reasonable that the linear term is zero, because if you give more power to a direction instead of the other, you have a state which is just moving, so it's not a momentum concern. So,
well, if I added such a term,
you raise it.
Yeah.
But,
but it's okay. There's a lot of bones. So if you really well, I'm not sure what you mean by momentum conserving, I guess.
No, I mean you end up with a total state for the quantum fluctuations, which has a total momentum which is not null. It is moving in one direction, which is not what you want, because.
Maybe this is not right, but so if I look at delta k, let's go back to the object, fundamental object. So it's got a delta function here. And the fact that this was a delta function is what I was viewing as a consequence of translational invariance. Somehow, so we're not breaking translational invariance, that's for sure. It's true, it has a sort of a dipole effect if you have something linear. The reason I said you might have to construct a model that violates translational invariance is because if I think of k as a momentum, if I want something linear in it, it's like a dp dt, so it's a linear in it's like a dx dt, so it's a linear in time. So, but I don't see why it would.
It should come with a complex coefficient, I suppose, because your correlation function should be real, so you should have k minus k.
Well,
complex invariance.
Yeah, that's true.
So my experience is that these terms usually disappear.
You're just giving more power in a direction instead of the opposite direction.
I think that can be removed by some transformation of x for in x space.
Yeah,
no,
of course.
No,
then
I don't
boost.
Think so.
Then you have to boost, of course.
But
not in that coordinate frame. If you want the universe to be homogeneous and average momentum zero in that coordinate frame.
Well, we're always working in the rest frame of the microwave
background,
and this effect would persist. You could try to mask it by a moving effect. Anyways, if your intuition tells you it's very hard to get such a term, I'm very happy to hear that. Since we assumed it wasn't there. And we couldn't, you know, this type of model that I just described, where all the effects come through gravity, basically I had this field and its gravitation gave rise to the effect, it did not induce such a linear term. Also, I have this field here. I could also do something else. I could add a term, u mu, u nu, d mu chi, d nu pi, it ends up, if I add this, it gives you something that's exactly scale invariant. But again, it's quadratic. It's not the linear term we were talking about. And I just couldn't figure out, you know, I couldn't figure out what to do to get a linear term.
I want to make a comment, but for a few minutes, if you allow me.
You want to come up front?
Come
on.
Yeah, I would do it.
Okay.
It's very curious to me to hear this talk, because in 1990, I was working on exactly this person designing a very similar phenomenon.
I hope you're not the person whose name has the C in
there. Actually, we published a paper with Chibisov, Ivan Chibisov from Lebedev Institute, and myself. I was his PhD student at that time. It was 1990. Paper that will be here.
Maybe you want this. You're going to give a whole lecture.
It's International Journal of Human Physics. Three, four.